quite often we'll want to keep that label of I'm a bad person off of ourselves, but the fact of the matter is that it's out of our inner life that those sins are born out of anyway. The example is you've seen maybe parents say, oh, that's not a my kid's not a bad kid, he just messed up that one time, you know, he's not a bad person. We try to keep that bad person label off of ourselves, but really what's the truth is that we do bad things. If that came out, you're the type of person to do bad things. Here's an example. Let's pretend I lose my temper and I yell at Tracy, my wife. Now, if I do that, does that mean I turned into a mean person who yells at their wife and then after that I turn back into a nice person? Or does it mean I'm the type of person who yells at my wife? Which one does it mean? Because a lot of times we'll pretend, oh, I'm not a bad person, I just did this one thing one time. But no, you're the type of person to do those things precisely by the definition of what it means to be a person who does those things because you did them. What I'm trying to say is you don't magically transform into a person who does something bad and then you transform back into a person who's a good person. So, oh, I'm not a bad person, I just do a couple bad things. You do those things, that's who you are. It's born out of our habits about our sin, about what we do sometimes behind closed doors, sometimes what we do when we're not around those people that occasionally that door opens up and, yeah, there's a sinner in there. That's the type of person that I have been on the inside. And I introduced our Mission Impossible last week. The video introduced it just now. We are to become like Christ. From our end, that is an impossible mission. We're always going to be trying. We should always be trying. But we won't be fully like Christ until he comes back and remakes us. God can do it because it's without him, all things are possible. But from our perspective, sort of this impossible mission of trying to replace who we are. The gift of God is free, but we still work on our end, not to receive the salvation, but because we have the salvation. And we're creatures of habit. We've got sinful habits, we've got sinful things going on in our lives, and that's why those things creep out sometimes. And so the way we can address that, what this impossible mission will hopefully be, is replacing some of those habits. Spiritual disciplines is just another word for habits. That's what it is. It's just these ones are hopefully good habits that you want to instill in your life and work on and make into who you are instead of the other habits that we might have. The act of replacing our habits is practicing the spiritual disciplines. Romans alone says that salvation is a gift of God 35 times. And so when we talk about these things, it's very easy to make them into a checklist of what you should be doing to be a good Christian. But it's a gift of God. We've got God's salvation if you accept it. But the same author, Paul, the apostle, also wrote in Galatians 6:8, he said this, he said, "For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life." This is the truth there, you reap what you sow. You want to reap the good habits, or sow the good habits in your life, so you reap the good fruit out of your life. God has given us the gift of being recreated as a new person, but just like the farmer is not the one who makes the seed sprout open and turn into something that's useful, God's the one who does that in us, but we're still told sometimes to till the soil or to water the plant or to, you know, take care of the plant that is in our lives. We want to sow good things there. Last week we talked about the two disciplines of submission and service. This week we are talking about the disciplines, apparently like the letter S, silence, Sabbath, and solitude. Those are the ones we're going to talk about. They all three fall into a category called the disciplines of abstinence. Abstinence is a word meaning that we abstain from something. We know this word. It's used in our culture today as abstaining from sex. Sex abstinence means you don't have sex. But the word abstinence means abstaining from anything. It means holding back, saying, no, I'm not going to participate in that. It's also called ascetism, which is the Greek word for training. You might have heard of ascetic monks, maybe, if you ever studied church father history. They're the ones who abstained from things. This practice, while it can be taken too far, all of the spiritual disciplines can be taken in ways they shouldn't go, but it is biblical practice, though. 1 Peter 2:11 is sort of reminds us of this. It tells us to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Lou read that for us earlier, that passage that it's in. I hope you all could read him, or not read him, could hear him. But 1 Peter 2:11, it is, abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. One translation, instead of saying passions of the flesh, just says lusts. And we know, yeah, you're not supposed to participate in lust. You're not supposed to participate in passions of the flesh. We get that. That's easy. But that's obvious. But the part that's not as always so obvious is lusts and passions of the flesh, they're things that God instilled in us to be used in creation. We just have perverted them a little bit. Like our lusts and our temptations to sin, a lot of times we just want something that God originally had good intentions for, and we perverted it, and that's what it's become, and now it's a temptation to sin instead of wanting to do what God originally really wanted us to do with that desire in our hearts. And so to teach ourselves how to abstain from the passions of the lust, passions and lusts, instead of teaching ourselves to abstain from the perversions, sometimes it's just easier to teach ourselves to abstain from the normal desires in the first place. And that's the spiritual disciplines of abstinence. So like fasting, it's not a sin to eat food, but if you train yourself to abstain from something that's not even a temptation, when that desire gets perverted, it's easier to abstain from the perverted desire. Does that make sense? So that's why you train yourselves. It's like finding a sparring partner to get ready for the big boxing match. The sparring partner is not going to beat you up and make you be bleeding pulp, but the championship fight might be. And so we're teaching ourselves how to fight against a sparring partner, these normal desires, before we end up in the ring with the guy wanting our championship title, something like that. We learn to fight by fighting the normal things, not the temptations, so that when we do end up against Satan, we're used to some of those things. We can withhold from some of those things a little better. In the sermons to come throughout the series, some of them will be more disciplines of abstinence, but this one has three all at once, silence, Sabbath, and solitude. And so I'll start out talking about the discipline of silence. And here's a question that I think I know the answer to most of you, from most of you. Have you ever taken a vow of silence? Yeah, not many people. First service, nobody said yes either. I have done it. It actually can be pretty cool. I did it in a group setting one time. I've done it twice now. I was at a spiritual formation thing where we basically pretended to be monks in this really great setting for a while. And we did a worship service after dinner, and after that, no one talks. We dismiss in silence, and we all stay in silence until the next morning when we are sitting there on a porch overlooking the sun rising over these mountains, and we all join in a unison of the same chorus at once. It was really cool, and that's how we broke the vow of silence. Really awesome to do. It's when you're seeing a sunrise over a mountain, it's like, and you valley in like this, they're called the Smoky Mountains for a reason. I don't know if you've seen them. It's when puffs of smoke, the clouds like weave between the mountains, and it just looks awesome. And it's hard to not feel spiritual in those moments. But other times, though, silence can be really scary. You know what I mean by that? Like, silence can, it's not always super cool, especially if you're not used to it. I mean, in that situation, I could hear the birds and things like that. But living at home, I don't get to experience silence very often. Small children, if Dora's not trying to teach me how to speak something in Spanish, then I have a daughter who's yelling, "Daddy, watch me, look at this, look what I can do." And it's like a different, slightly different take on a spin that she can do is what she's trying to show me. I'm constantly hearing children noise. And I think that's true for a lot of us, even if you don't have children. We're constantly have noise going on of some form or fashion of another. One time, though, my whole family was gone for the day. They had an errand to do in St. Louis, and I stayed in town here. And so I go home, and I'm eating dinner. And when my plate is done, I realize it's really loud in here. Is what I realized. Have you ever noticed that the silence can be loud? Like it starts to get like deafening. Like it's almost like a thudding, drawn out thud sound in your head. I don't know. I love silence in nature, but silence in a house in the middle of a neighborhood, in an empty home, it can get loud. Like you get so quiet and you realize, is that like my heartbeat I can hear right now? Have you ever had it that quiet before? It can be scary, because it's just not normal. I ended up turning on the TV because I couldn't take it. And so, like, silence is not something most of us are used to. But here's a key verse for the spiritual discipline, though, and that's Psalm 46:10. In that psalm, God says, "Be still and know that I am God." How can we know that he is God if we're never still enough to listen to him being God? Is what that verse, one of the things that verse is asking. Now, complete silence is often shocking, I think, because it makes us feel like nothing's going on. So often we think if there's activity around us, things are happening. But then if we stop the activity, if we stop that noise, then there's nothing going on. But then one author makes this point. He says, think about what it says about the inward emptiness of our lives if we must always turn on the tape player or radio to make sure something's happening around us. Think about what that says. If we have to have activity around us to feel like something's going on, what does it say about what's going on in our hearts? Not much. Yeah. Either you're saying it doesn't say much or saying not much is going on in our hearts. Yeah. It says that if we can't handle silence around us because we feel like nothing's going on, is there anything going on inside of us? There should be, and we should be allowing ourselves to listen to it. A lot of what we force ourselves to listen to is just white noise. Whether or not it's Netflix or the fans on our computers or the chirps on our phones and things such as that, the text messages, even the tick-tocking of a clock, or like, I can hear the air conditioner blowing right now. There's just all kinds of white noise, and rarely do we ever just sit back and say, let's have some silence here. There's an interesting phrase in messianic prophecy from Isaiah that Jesus quotes in Matthew chapter 12. It's a good one. This isn't the main point of that prophecy, but Jesus sort of, it's sort of one of those nuggets of truth you find, and then it's like, whoa, that's a cool thought. It's not the point of the passage, but it's in there. It says about the Messiah, he will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. But some translators don't just say, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. They say, nor will anyone hear his voice above the street noise. The Messiah, it says, is going to come, and he's not going to shout and hop up and down and try and grab all of your attention. It says people are not going to hear him over the noise of the streets. And I've got a feeling that first century Palestine, or even earlier when the prophecy was given, those streets were a lot quieter than our streets. Like a whole lot quieter than our streets. And it says the Messiah won't be heard over that noise. And so, if we want to avoid the noise, we want to avoid the noise of the streets so we can hear the voice of God and hear the Messiah. Not only is it an effective way to listen to him, but it's also an effective way to worship him too. It's prescribed in scripture sometimes. That's how you show God you're listening, is by making it quiet. Job, for example, we remember Job's story. Job's the guy who had a great life. It was ripped away from him. And then his next several dozen chapters is Job wanting to complain, his friends telling him to complain. He sort of does complain, but he never does curse God, though. That's the crux of it. He never does do that. But then God finally shows up, and God's answer to Job is, stop. I'm God and you're not. That's the answer God gives Job in the book of Job, if you've read it. His life is horrible. It's the worst of anyone's life could possibly be. And God's answer to him is, I'm God. And Job's response is, I place my hand over my mouth. That's what he says when God shows up. It's, I've said too much already. I'm going to shut up. That's Job's answer to God. And Job's blessed for the right answer to God, actually, in that passage in the book of Job. It's also said in other passages as well. Zephaniah 1:7 says, be silent before the sovereign Lord. Isaiah, when he goes in the throne room, he's caught up in a vision, goes before the throne room, and he says, I'm a person of unclean lips, and he doesn't want to talk before the throne of God. It's a proper response to God. Like, it's similar to going before a king. You don't always go before a king and just talk to him. Sometimes you be quiet and you listen to what the king has to say. That's proper throne room etiquette, if I understand correctly. So one easy way to practice this discipline of silence is stop talking so much. We like to talk. I like to talk. I'm talking to you quite a bit right now. I do it every Sunday morning for about a 20 minutes to a half hour, depending on how long the sermon is. But also, like, in conversation, if it's a good story I want to tell, I like to hear myself tell stories, I think. And so I'll tell people, and we can just, you know what, it's okay to not talk so much. And that's a lesson for me as much as anyone else. Because think about it, though. How often do you just wish you wouldn't have said something, but it's already out there and it's already said, and it would have been better to just not have said it, but it's too late? That's one thing this discipline is for, is that we train ourselves not to talk so often. And it's an important thing. James, the book of James in chapter 3, he says that if anyone is able to control his tongue, he is perfect. That's what James says for the person who can control their tongue. He said, if you got that, you're good. He also says it's like a rudder that steers the ship. It guides our whole life. So we need to quit using it just, here's words, and just spew them out of our mouths. We can probably do better to control them a little bit more. God created the world with words, and he made us in his image, so words are powerful. And that's sort of a side note, but it goes in with this discipline of sometimes it's okay to practice silence. Another way to practice silence, sometimes the only way for some of us to practice silence, depending on your life situation, is in the discipline of solitude. The next discipline is solitude. And solitude's definition is purposefully abstaining from interaction with other human beings, denying companionship and all that comes from our conscious interaction with others. It is choosing to be alone and to dwell on our experience of isolation. And you might go, hey, Adam, that does not sound very Christian. Because just a few weeks ago, I preached about how you're supposed to be in community, and that's when the body of Christ shows up, and when two or three gather together, that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? And that's when Jesus is there. And yes, that's true. The disciplines have a line where some of them will cease to be useful. But we pick a sparring partner before we get in the real fights. Sometimes we need to know when to walk away from someone. Sometimes we should avoid certain people because when we're around them, we go down the wrong path. Sometimes there is someone who should have the discipline of church discipline being practiced, and so you shouldn't be around them. Sometimes certain situations demand we need to be okay with letting people go and not being around them. That's one thing you learn in the spiritual discipline of solitude. But solitude is also important because it couples with some other spiritual disciplines too. But like I said, it might be the only way for some of us actually to practice silence. Again, we have the example of Christ in this. Jesus Christ practiced the discipline of solitude. If you've read through the Gospels, you'll notice time and time again when it says things like he went off alone to pray, or he went off alone to be away from the crowds. He went and did this by himself. It says that quite often. Luke 6:12 is just one example of one of those passages that talks about that, but I won't read it. And he's the guy who arguably should have been around people the most. Arguably, you could make the case that Jesus should never have stepped away from people. He should have always been with crowds because Jesus, he's got the most important things to say of anyone. He's got the power to help everyone. He was able to heal the sick and do all these other miracles. Why in the world would Jesus ever have been alone and away from people? But Jesus is our example of he stepped away and was willing to be alone. I think part of the reason why he was able to be alone is that he knew his place. Jesus didn't have any problems with self-identity. We sometimes need to be in company because it's only in certain company that we feel loved, or it's around certain people that we feel needed. It's around certain people that they're the ones who makes us happy. When sometimes we need to learn that our identity is not necessarily found in others, it should be found in Christ. And so we need to be alone with him. Jesus didn't have any problem with knowing who he was, and he was able to be alone. And perhaps it's in seclusion only that we might actually discover that we're truly never alone. But we won't actually get the opportunity to figure that out unless we let ourselves start to be. See, we in the Western culture, we really love individualism, but we are not individualistic. We really love to think of ourselves highly. We really love to be like, oh, this is my special niche in the world. But we really aren't that individualistic. For example, what is your favorite TV show? Do you have any idea how many millions of people watch that TV show? What is your favorite song? Any idea how many millions of people like that same song? Any of you like some like small artists, how many dozens of people like that same song? We're creatures of wanting to be in community and wanting to be like each other. Even in subculture groups like hipsters or emo groups, they still have their subculture, and that's why they're a subculture. They've got other people around which to be. It's people we like to conform, is one point I'm trying to make here. Is we like to be in groups. We like to pattern each other after ourselves. We follow the same patterns, the things we like or what other people like as well. And that, I think, is a God-given thing. We're supposed to be in community, but it can go too far because the problem is we like to conform. But we like to conform, and the world is full of sinful people. And that can be an issue depending on whom we conform with. We don't like to stand out in a crowd. We like to blend in a little bit, unless you're the type of personality that likes to stand out in a crowd, and then the reason why you like to stand out in a crowd is because you like the crowd to be around you. And so that's our kind of personalities, is we like to just fit in and either not be noticed or be noticed so that we have a crowd. But that can be a bad thing, because then we're becoming like the crowd, who is full of sinful people. Did you know that scientists apparently discovered that if you have a group of mice and all of them are poisoned except for one, the one that is not poisoned is going to die just as fast as the poisoned ones? That doesn't matter if he's in the group to start with or if you put him into the society after the rest of them have been poisoned. Apparently, what happens is he dies just as quick as the poisoned ones. In many ways, society has been poisoned. And sometimes it wouldn't hurt to go and detox for a while away alone. Not to say we're mice, but all metaphors break down. But solitude is the ability to make sure that you actually spend time alone. Being disciplined, and it means you know how you can be by yourself and not be with the poisoned society. It's foundational, actually, to almost all the other spiritual disciplines. We're going to talk about them later. In prayer and fasting, though, what does Jesus say about those? He says, when you pray, do it alone. When you fast, don't let people know what's going on. How can you keep a secret if you're not able to ever be alone? It's foundational to these other disciplines. If you're someone who receives your worth from others, if you're someone who receives your worth based on how many Facebook likes or retweets or something like that you have, then you're going to be hard-pressed to keep things secret. But we are a communal people, and God built us like that on purpose. We're supposed to be in a community. I think we're based off our ways that we interact with it. In some ways, it's based off the Trinity. God's got eternal community with himself for all of time in the past and all time in the future. He is able to have community. And we're built to be somewhat like that. We're supposed to be in community. But only when we are completely alone can we dwell on just the Lord alone, or else our attentions will be divided in some way. Now, the passage I referenced for not-so-trivial trivia, 1 Kings 19, we read an interesting piece of the story of Elijah the prophet. We learn that he was so disheartened that he became suicidal at one point. He actually goes off alone and wants to die, and God shows up instead, it's a cool passage. And verses 9 through 13 is what I'll read at 1 Kings 19. Elijah, there he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke it in pieces and the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It's a really cool story, and you should read it later on, because I'm not going to go to all the details of the story and what happens. And God encourages him. And God reveals to him that things are not as bad as they seem. There's reason to take heart and have hope. And God's going to take care of him. But it was when Elijah went off to be both alone and be silent that he was able to hear this whisper from God that ended up encouraging him and really bringing Elijah back from near the grave. It was in that stillness that he could hear God. And so we talked about silence, which is the absence of noise. We talked about solitude, which is the absence of people. And now we're going to talk about Sabbath, which is the absence of work. And here's one question. Does it seem weird when I say that Christians should practice the Sabbath? It's kind of controversial in some circles. We talk about Sabbath. I don't mean, though, by practicing the Sabbath that you aren't supposed to work at all on Sundays or Saturdays or whatever, pick whatever day you want to call the seventh day, and you keep it holy by not doing any work on that day. A family member of mine, my grandmother, before she passed away, she got involved with this church that actually taught you weren't supposed to work on Saturdays whatsoever. Not at all. And what was interesting about that is they weren't allowed to cook in their group, but they were willing to go to a restaurant and pay someone else to sin for them. which I did not understand that one at all. But that's not what I mean, though. I mean that we should enter into the habit of seeking after God's rest. We should enter into the habit of taking a break sometimes. The book of Hebrews, especially chapters 3 and 4, it talks about it in great detail. Jesus completed God's work, and now we look forward to entering into the rest with him. I'm thankful that I live outside a time where I don't have to follow the Sabbath command to a T, and the law has been fulfilled. And because there are some practicing Jews that will make sure they trim their nails at the right time during the week so that their nails are growing the least amount possible during the Sabbath. Because if their nails were growing too much, they'd be working. And like, I would fail. I would not get to go to heaven if that's the law under which I lived. So I am really happy that Jesus completed the work, and Sabbath now means looking forward to the day of rest when he comes back. I'm super happy for that, because I would lose. I just would. I'd give up. But Sabbath looks forward and backward in time. It looks backward all the way to the days of creation, when God worked for 7 days, or 6 days, on the seventh day he rested. It looks back to when God did his creating work. It also looks forward to the time when God does his recreating work, when he will act, and then we'll get to rest for eternity with him in heaven. But it doesn't just look forward or look backward only to the time of creation. It also looks backward to the time of Christ's work. Back when Christ said that it is finished. He said it's finished, so all work will never be as good as that work ever. Really, work is done, essentially, based off of Christ's yelling and saying that it is finished. So must we rest on Sundays or Saturdays or whatever the day is? No. In Mark 2:27, even before he said it was finished, he pointed out that Sabbath was not made, or that man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for the man. While he was working, they were picking food and eating. He said that on a Sabbath day. But we are to keep a day of remembrance of the Lord as holy in some way. The principle of abstaining from the work is the most important part. The principle of looking forward to God's day of rest. We must recognize the need to rest throughout our regular lives because God declared on the cross that it is finished. There's no more important work to be done than what has already been completed. Except telling others about that good news, which that's a job that we do have. But in Sabbath rest, we acknowledge that God has accomplished everything that could ever be accomplished that's worth getting done. So we join in God's work, but while the battles rage, the war was won a long time ago, and so our work should be fun work. Like, it's not just like menial tasks, it's fun stuff. And in that, we can even find rest in there. But sometimes we need to sit back and say, God's got the whole world in his hands. If I don't finish my to-do list, it's going to be okay. I think all of us have too long, some of us, some people, you'd never write down to-do lists, but some of us, my to-do list is scary. I hate to look at it almost sometimes. Your honey-do list in the back of your mind will never go away all the way. There's always going to be something to be done. But sometimes you just need to rest and say, you know what? It's okay if I don't finish everything. I can relax for a minute. Granted, we'll never fully get to rest until Christ returns. Hebrews 4:8-10 tells us about that day. But we should be able to celebrate that he's finished and all the work is done. We should be able to celebrate that. Let's be willing to admit that the world does not rest on our shoulders, because it doesn't. If one of us was no longer ever to do anything ever again, it's still finished. And God will take care of those things that need to get done. It's in God's hands, because we'll never run out of things to do. Some of us might be a little too willing to stop work, But some of you here, and I think you know who you are, you need that reminder to take a Sabbath sometimes and to sit back and be content in relaxation. So I'd like to end on this thought, and it's that, are you willing to give up on that to which we've become so accustomed? Set aside a chunk of time this week. When I originally wrote the sermon, I wanted to write an hour, but then I read a book that said people who've never practiced silence before need to start with just 10 minutes. So I don't know, maybe you can do an hour. Let's try. I think it's possible. But at least 10 minutes, even in our busy worlds, we can do that. Might mean you've got to wake up a little earlier or do something or change your lunch routine, but it's worth it. Set aside a chunk of time, decide what that chunk of time is and stick to it. Don't cut out halfway through. Whatever you decided in advance, stick to that. And in that time, just be alone and be silent and rest. I can breathe. Maybe even hear that deafening silence that only occurs when you actually don't have noise around you, when you're forced to either look inward at yourself or outward to Christ, but nowhere else. Don't look other places. It might be scary. I know it's going to be awkward. If you've never sat in silence before, it will be awkward, and you're not going to know what to do. And 2 minutes in, you'll be like, what else am I supposed to do? But do it anyway and experience that. You won't have the noise to distract you or people to occupy you. Please don't dare bring your smartphones with you. Don't get on the internet. The internet is like the worst encroachment on Sabbath to ever come across mankind, I think. It's a great useful tool, but it's got a whole lot of sharp edges on that tool that you got to be really careful with. But it is very useful, but just be very careful when you're using it. But don't have the internet when you're doing your silent time. It might sound neat for some of you. Some of you might have those disciplines built into your life in some way, or you resonate with those in some special way already, so you may not have to work as hard on this. Again, the purpose of the series is not to teach you everything you need to know about these disciplines, but it's to whet your appetite and realize, hey, these disciplines exist. Maybe there's a couple I can go after. But I want everyone to at least try this one this week. But the rest of us, though, who aren't used to that some moments of silence in our lives, you're going to get antsy. You're going to feel awkward. Try and do it anyway. And before you even get halfway through, you're going to wonder, what's the point of even continuing on? And here's the good news. If you do fail, you break the silence, or you get up and start working or something like that, it's the sparring partner. It's okay if you lose against the sparring partner. But remember, it's the sparring partner. Figure out how to beat the sparring partner before you're stuck against real temptations and real trials. So, are you committing some egregious sin if, like, you're fasting and you eat some food? No. During the time, the moments I talked about during that time of silence, somebody bumped into me when we passed each other, and he said, oh, sorry. And I was like, he in super big trouble because he broke the vow of silence? No, he was being polite. It's okay if you fail against the sparring partner, but it's worth practicing against the sparring partner, because there will be times when we'll be fighting against the champion of this world, Satan. And so we need to have some of the practice. The good news is Jesus is going to win the battle, the war, no matter what. But on the way, sometimes we will get into scuffles. Teach and train your soul to fight temptations, because bigger fights are coming. It's an impossible mission to become fully like Christ. It's a possible mission on God's end, impossible from us, but it is a very possible mission on our end to replace some of our habits with habits that are worth pursuing. One author writes, solitude well practiced will break the power of busyness, haste, isolation, and loneliness. You will see the world is not on your shoulders after all. You will find yourself, and God will find you in new ways. Silence also brings Sabbath to you. It completes solitude, for without it you cannot be alone. Far from being a mere absence, silence allows the reality of God to stand in the midst of your life. God does not ordinarily compete for our attention. In silence, we come to attend him. That's one reason why it's worth practicing these things, because the Messiah lets the noise of the street overpower his voice. One day he won't. One day it's going to be loud trumpets and he won't compete with the noise of the street. But right now, we need to tune out the noise of the street so we can listen to him during this lifetime. And so your mission, should you choose to accept it, is be silent. Practice being alone, be still. Learn to rest in Christ alone.